strike. What exactly is keeping John at the office? If he isn't going to make it, I'll arrange an alternative appointment with him. I've got other people to see this afternoon. Is he still trying to sort out this Conway Oates business? He only knew what Ursula had told him, that Conway Oates had been an American financier, but this mention of the firm's dead client had the desired effect. Landry's pomposity, his desire to control the encounter, his comfortable air of superiority vanished entirely, leaving him clothed in nothing but temper and shock. John hasn't... Can he really have been so... That is strictly confidential business of the firm.
It wasn't John, said Strike.
Mrs. Ursula May mentioned that there's been a bit of trouble round Mr. Oates's estate. Clearly thrown, Landry spluttered, I'm very surprised. I wouldn't have expected Ursula, Mrs. May. So will John be along at all, or have you given him something that will keep him busy all through lunch? He enjoyed watching Landry wrestle his own temper, trying to regain control of himself and the encounter. John will be here shortly, he said finally. I hoped, as I said, to be able to lay certain facts in front of you, in private.
Right, well, in that case I'll need these, said Strike, removing a notebook and pen from his pocket.
Landry looked quite as put out by the sight of these objects as Tansy had. There's no need to take notes, he said. What I'm about to say has no bearing, or at least no direct bearing, on Lula's death. That is, he added pedantically, it will add nothing to any theory other than that of suicide.
All the same, said Strike, I like to have my aide-memoir.
Landry looked as though he would like to protest, but thought better of it.
Very well, then.
Firstly, you should know that my nephew John was deeply affected by his adopted sister's death.
Understandable, commented Strike,
tilting the notebook so that the lawyer could not read it, and writing the words, deeply affected, purely to annoy Landry.
Yes, naturally.
And while I would never go so far as to suggest that a private detective refuse a client on the basis that they are under strain or depressed, as I said, we all have our livings to make, in this case...
You think it's all in his head?
That's not how I'd have phrased it, but bluntly, yes. John has already suffered more sudden bereavements than many people experience in a lifetime. You probably weren't aware that he's already lost a brother.
Yeah, I knew. Charlie was an old schoolmate of mine. That's why John hired me.
Landry contemplated Strike with what seemed to be surprise and disfavour.
You were at Blakeyfield Prep? Briefly, before my mother realised she couldn't afford the fees.
I see. I did not know that.
Even so, perhaps you're not fully aware, John has always been, let's use my sister's expression for it, highly strung. His parents had to bring in psychologists after Charlie died, you know. I don't claim to be a mental health expert, but it seems to me that Lula's passing has finally tipped him over the...
Unfortunate choice of phrase, but I see what you mean, said Strike, writing Bristow off rocker.
How exactly has John been tipped over the edge?
Well, many would say that instigating this reinvestigation is irrational and pointless, said Landry.
Strike kept his pen poised over the notepad. For a moment, Landry's jaws moved as though he was chewing. Then he said forcefully, Lula was a manic depressive who jumped out of the window after a row with her junkie boyfriend. There is no mystery. It was goddamn awful for all of us, especially her poor bloody mother, but those are the unsavoury facts. I'm forced to the conclusion that John is having some kind of breakdown, and if you don't mind me speaking frankly...
Feel free.
Your collusion is perpetuating his unhealthy refusal to accept the truth.
Which is that Lula killed herself.
A view that is shared by the police, the pathologist, and the coroner. John, for reasons that are obscure to me, is determined to prove murder. How he thinks that will make any of us feel any better, I could not tell you.
Well, said Strike, people close to suicides often feel guilty. They think, however unreasonably, that they might have done more to help. A murder verdict would exonerate the family of any blame, wouldn't it?
None of us has anything to feel guilty about, said Landry, his tone steely. Lula received the very best medical care from her early teens, and every material advantage her adoptive family could give her. Spoilt rotten might be the phrase best suited to describe my adopted niece, Mr. Strike. Her mother would have literally died for her, and scant repayment she ever received.
You thought Lula ungrateful, did you?
There's no need to bloody write that down. Or are those notes destined for some tawdry rag? Strike was interested in how completely Landry had jettisoned the suavity he had brought to the table. The waitress arrived with Landry's food. He did not thank her, but glared at Strike until she had passed on. Then he said, "You're poking around where you can only do harm. I was stunned, frankly, when I found out what John was up to. Stunned."
"Hadn't he expressed doubts about the suicide theory to you?"
"He'd expressed shock, naturally, like all of us. But I certainly don't recall any suggestion of murder."
"Are you close to your nephew, Mr. Landry?"
"What has that got to do with anything?"
"It might explain why he didn't tell you what he was thinking."
"John and I have a perfectly amicable working relationship."
"Working relationship?"
"Yes, Mr. Strike. We work together. Do we live in each other's pockets outside the office? No. But we are both involved in caring for my sister, Lady Bristow, John's mother, who is now a terminal case. Our out-of-hours conversations usually concern Yvette."
"John strikes me as a dutiful son."
"Yvette's all he has left now, and the fact that she's dying isn't helping his medical condition either."
"She's hardly all he's got left. There's Alison, isn't there?"
"I am not aware that that is a very serious relationship."
"Perhaps one of John's motives in employing me is a desire to give his mother the truth before she dies."
"The truth won't help Yvette. Nobody enjoys accepting that they have reaped what they have sown." Strike said nothing. As he had expected, the lawyer could not resist the temptation to clarify, and after a moment he continued, "Yvette has always been morbidly maternal. She adores babies." He spoke as though this was fairly disgusting, a kind of perversion. "She would have been one of those embarrassing women who have 20 children if she could have found a man of sufficient virility. Thank God Alec was sterile. Or hasn't John mentioned that?"
"He told me Sir Alec Bristow wasn't his natural father, if that's what you mean."
If Landry was disappointed not to be first with the information, he rallied at once. "Yvette and Alec adopted the two boys, but she had no idea how to manage them. She is, quite simply, an atrocious mother. No control, no discipline. Complete overindulgence and a point-blank refusal to see what is under her nose. I don't say it was all down to her parenting. Who knows what the genetic influences were. But John was whiny, histrionic and clingy, and Charlie was completely delinquent, with the result..." Landry stopped talking abruptly, patches of colour high in his cheeks.
"With the result that he rode over the edge of a quarry," Strike suggested.
He had said it to watch Landry's reaction, and was not disappointed. He had the impression of a tunnel contracting, a distant door closing, a shutting down. "Not to put too fine a point on it, yes." "And it was a bit late then for Yvette to start screaming and clawing at Alec and passing out cold on the floor. If she'd had an iota of control, the boy wouldn't have set out expressly to defy her."
"I was there," said Landry stonily,
"on a weekend visit, Easter Sunday. I had been for a walk down to the village, and I came back to find them all looking for him. I headed straight for the quarry. I knew, you see. It was the place he'd been forbidden to go, so there he was."
"You found the body, did you?"
"Yes, I did."
"That must have been highly distressing."
"Yes," said Landry, his lips barely moving. "It was."
"And it was after Charlie died, wasn't it, that your sister and Sir Alec adopted Lula?"
"Which was probably the single most stupid thing Alec Bristow ever agreed to," said Landry. "Yvette had already proven herself a disastrous mother. Was she likely to be any more successful while in a state of abandoned grief? Of course, she'd always wanted a daughter, a baby to dress in pink, and Alec thought it would make her happy. He always gave Yvette anything she wanted. He was besotted with her from the moment she joined his typing pool, and he was an unvarnished East Ender. Yvette has always had a predilection for a bit of rough. Strike wondered what the real source of Landry's anger could be.
"You don't get along with your sister, Mr. Landry?" asked Strike.
"We get along perfectly well. It is simply that I am not blind to what Yvette is, Mr. Strike, nor how much of her misfortune is her own damn fault."
"Was it difficult for them to get approved for another adoption after Charlie died?" asked Strike.
"I dare say it would have been if Alec hadn't been a multimillionaire," snorted Landry. "I know the authorities were concerned about Yvette's mental health, and they were both a bit long in the tooth by then. It's a great pity that they weren't turned down. But Alec was a man of infinite resourcefulness, and he had all sorts of strange contacts from his barrow boy days. I don't know the details, but I'd be prepared to bet money changed hands somewhere. Even so, he couldn't manage a Caucasian. He brought another child of completely unknown provenance into the family, to be raised by a depressed and hysterical woman of no judgment. It was hardly a surprise to me that the result was catastrophic. Lula was as unstable as John and as wild as Charlie, and Yvette had just as little idea how to manage her.
Scribbling away for Landry's benefit, Strike wondered whether his belief in genetic predetermination accounted for some of Bristow's preoccupation with Lula's black relatives. Doubtless Bristow had been privy to his uncle's views through the years. Children absorb the views of their relatives at some deep, visceral level. He, Strike, had known in his bones, long before the words had ever been said in front of him, that his mother was not like other mothers, that there was, if he believed in the unspoken code that bound the rest of the adults around him, something shameful about her.
"You saw Lula the day she died, I think," Strike said. Landry's eyelashes were so fair, they looked silver.
"Excuse me?"
"Yeah."
Strike flicked back through his notebook ostentatiously, coming to a halt at an entirely blank page.
"You met her at your sister's flat, didn't you, when Lula called in to see Lady Bristow?"
"Who told you that? John?"
"It's all in the police file. Isn't it true?"
"Yes, it's perfectly true, but I can't see how it's relevant to anything we've been discussing."
"I'm sorry. When you arrived, you said you'd been expecting to hear from me. I got the impression you were happy to answer questions."
Landry had the air of a man who has found himself unexpectedly snookered.
"I have nothing to add to the statement I gave to the police," he said at last.
"Which is," said Strike, leafing backwards through blank pages, "that you dropped in to visit your sister that morning, where you met your niece, and that you then drove to Oxford to attend a conference on international developments in family law."
Landry was chewing on air again.
"That's correct," he said. "What time would you say you arrived at your sister's flat?"
"It must have been about 10, said Landry, after a short pause.
"And you stayed how long?"
"Half an hour, perhaps. Maybe longer. I really can't remember."
"And you drove directly from there to the conference in Oxford?"
Over Landry's shoulder, Strike saw John Bristow questioning a waitress. He appeared out of breath and a little dishevelled, as though he had been running. A rectangular leather case dangled from his hand. He glanced around, panting slightly, and when he spotted the back of Landry's head, Strike thought that he looked frightened.
Chapter 6
"John," said Strike, as his client approached them.
"Hi, Cormoran."
Landry did not look at his nephew, but picked up his knife and fork and took a first bite of his tureen. Strike moved around the table to make room for Bristow to sit down opposite his uncle.
"Have you spoken to Reuben?"
Landry asked Bristow coldly, once he had finished his mouthful of tureen.
"Yes, I've said I'll go over this afternoon and take him through all the deposits and drawings."
"I've just been asking your uncle about the morning before Lulu died, John. About when he visited your mother's flat," said Strike.
Bristow glanced at Landry.
"I'm interested in what was said and done there," Strike continued, "because according to the chauffeur, who drove her back from her mother's flat, Lula seemed distressed."
"Of course she was distressed," snapped Landry. "Her mother had cancer. The operation she just had was supposed to have cured her, wasn't it? Yvette had just had a hysterectomy. She was in pain. I don't doubt Lula was disturbed at seeing her mother in that condition."
"Did you talk much to Lula when you saw her?"
A minuscule hesitation.
"Just chit-chat."
"And you two, did you speak to each other?"
Bristow and Landry did not look at each other. A longer pause of a few seconds before Bristow said, "I was working in the Home Office. I heard Tony come in, heard him speaking to Mum and Lula."
"You didn't look in to say hello?"
Strike asked Landry. Landry considered him through slightly boiled-looking eyes, pale between the light lashes.
"You know, nobody here is obliged to answer your questions, Mr. Strike," said Landry.
"Of course not," agreed Strike.
And he made a small and incomprehensible note in his pad. Bristow was looking at his uncle. Landry seemed to reconsider.
"I could see through the open door of the home study that John was hard at work, and I didn't want to disturb him. I sat with Yvette in her room for a while, but she was groggy from the painkillers, so I left her with Lula."
"I knew," said Landry, with the faintest undertone of spite, "that there was nobody Yvette would prefer to Lula."
"Lula's telephone records show that she called your mobile phone repeatedly after she left Lady Bristow's flat, Mr. Landry."
Landry flushed.
"Did you speak to her on the phone?"
"No. I had my mobile switched to silent. I was late for the conference."
"They vibrate, though, don't they?"
He wondered what it would take to make Landry leave. He was sure that the lawyer was close.
"I glanced at my phone, saw it was Lula and decided it could wait," he said shortly.
"You didn't call her back?"
"No."
"Didn't she leave any kind of message to tell you what she wanted to talk about?"
"No."
"That seems odd, doesn't it? You'd just seen her at her mother's, and you say nothing very important passed between you. Yet she spent much of the rest of the afternoon trying to contact you. Doesn't that seem as though she might have had something urgent to say to you? Or that she wanted to continue a conversation you'd been having at the flat?"
Lula was the kind of girl who would call somebody 30 times in a row on the flimsiest pretext. She was spoiled. She expected people to jump to attention at the sight of her name. Strike glanced at Bristow.
"She was sometimes a bit like that," her brother muttered.
"Do you think your sister was upset purely because your mother was weak from her operation, John?"
Strike asked Bristow.
"Her driver, Kieran Colovis-Jones, is emphatic that she came away from the flat in a dramatically altered mood."
Before Bristow could answer, Landry, abandoning his food, stood up and began to put on his overcoat.
"Is Colovis-Jones that strange-looking coloured boy?" he asked, looking down at Strike and Bristow.
"The one who wanted Lula to get him modelling and acting work?"
"He's an actor, yeah," said Strike.
"Yes, on Yvette's birthday, the last before she became ill, I had a problem with my car. Lula and that man called by to give me a lift to the birthday dinner. Colovis-Jones spent most of the journey badgering Lula to use her influence with Freddie Bastigui to get him an audition. Quite an encroaching young man. Very familiar in his manner.
Of course," he added, "the less I knew about my adopted niece's love life, the better, as far as I was concerned."
Landry threw a £10 note down on the table.
"I'll expect you back at the office soon, John."
He stood in clear expectation of a response, but Bristow was not paying attention. He was staring wide-eyed at the picture on the news story that Strike had been reading when Landry arrived. It showed a young black soldier in the uniform of the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers.
What? Yes, I'll be straight back, he told his uncle distractedly, who was looking at him coldly. Sorry, Bristow added to Strike, as Landry walked away. It's just that Wilson, Derek Wilson, you know, the security guard, he's got a nephew out in Afghanistan. For a moment, God forbid. But it's not him. Wrong name. Dreadful, this war, isn't it? And is it worth this loss of life?
Strike shifted the weight off his prosthesis. The trudge across the park had not helped the soreness in his leg, and made a non-committal noise.
Let's walk back, said Bristow, when they had finished eating. I fancy some fresh air.
Bristow chose the most direct route, which involved navigating stretches of lawn that Strike would not have chosen to walk on his own, because it demanded much more energy than tarmac. As they passed the memorial fountain to Diana, Princess of Wales, whispering, tinkling and gushing along its long channel of Cornish granite, Bristow suddenly announced, as though Strike had asked,
Tony's never liked me much.
He preferred Charlie. People said that Charlie looked like Tony did when he was a boy.
I can't say he spoke about Charlie with much fondness before you arrived, and he doesn't seem to have had much time for Lula either.
Didn't he give you his views on heredity?
By implication.
No, well, he's not usually shy about them. It made an extra bond between Lula and me. The fact that Uncle Tony considered us a pair of sow's ears. It was worse for Lula. At least my biological parents must have been white. Tony's not what you'd call unprejudiced. We had a Pakistani trainee last year. She was one of the best we'd ever had, but Tony drove her out.
What made you go and work with him?
They made me a good offer. It's the family firm. My grandfather started it. Not that that was an inducement. No one wants to be accused of nepotism. But it's one of the top family law firms in London, and it made my mother happy to think I was following in her father's footsteps. Did he have a go at my father?
Not really. He hinted that Sir Alec might have greased some palms to get Lula.
Really? Bristow sounded surprised. I don't think that's true. Lula was in care. I'm sure the usual procedures were followed. There was a short silence, after which Bristow said, a little timidly,
You don't look very much like your father.
It was the first time that he had acknowledged openly that he might have been sidetracked onto Wikipedia while researching private detectives.
No, agreed Strike. I'm the spitting image of my Uncle Ted.
I gather that you and your father aren't, you don't use his name.
Strike did not resent the curiosity from a man whose family background was almost as unconventional and casualty-strewn as his own.
I've never used it, he said. I'm the extramarital accident that cost Johnny a wife and several £1 million in alimony. We're not close.
I admire you, said Bristow, for making your own way, for not relying on him.
And when Strike did not answer, he added anxiously,
I hope you didn't mind me telling Tansy who your father is. It helped get her to talk to you. She's impressed by famous people.
All's fair in securing a witness statement, said Strike.
You say that Lula didn't like Tony, and yet she took his name professionally.
Oh, no. She chose Landry because it was Mum's maiden name. Nothing to do with Tony. Mum was thrilled. I think there was another model called Bristow. Lula liked to stand out.
They wove their way through passing cyclists, bench picnickers, dog walkers and roller skaters, Strike trying to disguise the increasing unevenness in his step.
I don't think Tony's ever really loved anyone in his life, you know, said Bristow suddenly, as they stood aside to allow a helmeted child wobbling along on a skateboard to pass. Whereas my mother's a very loving person. She loved all three of her children very much, and I sometimes think Tony didn't like it. I don't know why. It's something in his nature. There was a breach between him and my parents after Charlie died. I wasn't supposed to know what was said, but I heard enough. He as good as told Mum that Charlie's accident was her fault, that Charlie had been out of control. My father threw Tony out of the house. Mum and Tony were only really reconciled after Dad died. To Strike's relief, they had reached Exhibition Road, and his limp became less perceptible.
"Do you think there was ever anything between Lula and Kieran Colovis Jones?" he asked, as they crossed the street.
"No. That's just Tony leaping to the most unsavoury conclusion he can think of. He always thought the worst when it came to Lula. Oh, I'm sure Kieran would have been only too eager. But Lula was smitten by Duffield, more's the pity." They walked on down Kensington Road, with the leafy park to their left, and then into the white stuccoed territory of ambassadors' houses and royal colleges.
"Why do you think your uncle didn't come and say hello to you, when he called at your mother's the day she got out of hospital?"
Bristow looked intensely uncomfortable.
"Had there been a disagreement between you?"
Not exactly," said Bristow. "We were in the middle of a very stressful time at work. I ought not to say. Client confidentiality."
"Was this to do with the estate of Conway Oates?"
"How do you know that?" asked Bristow sharply. "Did Ursula tell you?"
"She mentioned something."
"Christ almighty. No discretion. None."
"Your uncle found it hard to believe that Mrs. May could have been indiscreet."
"I'll bet he did," said Bristow with a scornful laugh. Well, I'm sure I can trust you. It's the kind of thing a firm like ours is touchy about, because with the kind of clients we attract, high net worth, any hint of financial impropriety is death. Conway Oates held a sizable client account with us. All the money's present and correct. But his heirs are a greedy bunch, and they're claiming it was mismanaged. Considering how volatile the market's been, and how incoherent Conway's instructions became towards the end, they should be grateful there's anything left. Tony's irritable about the whole business, and, well, he's a man who likes to spread the blame around. There have been scenes. I've caught my share of criticism. I usually do, with Tony." Strike could tell, by the almost perceptible heaviness that seemed to be descending upon Bristow as he walked, that they were approaching his offices.
"I'm having difficulty contacting a couple of useful witnesses, John. Is there any chance you'd be able to put me in touch with Guy Sommet? His people don't seem keen on letting anyone near him."
"I can try. I'll call him this afternoon. He adored Lula. He ought to want to help."
"And there's Lula's birth mother, too."
"Oh, yes," sighed Bristow. "I've got her details somewhere. She's a dreadful woman."
"Have you met her?"
"No. I'm going on what Lula told me, and everything that was in the papers. Lula was determined to find out where she came from, and I think Duffield was encouraging her. I strongly suspect him of leaking the story to the press, though she always denied that. Anyway, she managed to track her down, this Hickson woman, who told her that her father was an African student. I don't know whether that was true or not. It was certainly what Lula wanted to hear. Her imagination ran wild. I think she had visions of herself being the long-lost daughter of a high-ranking politician or a tribal princess."
"But she never traced her father."
"I don't know, but," said Bristow, displaying his usual enthusiasm for any line of inquiry that might explain the black man caught on film near her flat, "I'd have been the last person she'd have told if she did."
"Why?"
"Because we'd had some pretty nasty rows about the whole business. My mother had just been diagnosed with uterine cancer when Lula went searching for Marlene Hickson. I told Lula that she could hardly have chosen a more insensitive moment to start tracing her roots, but she... well, frankly, she had tunnel vision where her own whims were concerned." "We loved each other," said Bristow, running a weary hand over his face. "But the age difference got in the way. I'm sure she tried to look for her father, though, because that was what she wanted more than anything. To find her black roots. To find that sense of identity."
"Was she still in contact with Marlene Hickson when she died?"
"Intermittently. I had the feeling that Lula was trying to cut the connection. Hickson's a ghastly person, shamelessly mercenary. She sold her story to anyone who would pay, which unfortunately was a lot of people. My mother was devastated by the whole business.
There are a couple of other things I want to ask you.
The lawyer slowed down willingly.
When you visited Lula at her flat that morning to return her contract with Sumay, did you happen to see anyone who looked like they might have been from a security firm, there to check the alarms?
Like a repairman?
Or an electrician, maybe in overalls?
When Bristow screwed up his face in thought, his rabbity teeth protruded more than ever. I can't remember, let me think. As I passed the flat on the second floor, yes, there was a man in there fiddling with something on the wall. Would that have been him?
Probably. What did he look like?
Well, he had his back to me, I couldn't see.
Was Wilson with him?
Bristow came to a halt on the pavement, looking a little bewildered. Three suited men and women bustled past, some carrying files.
I think, he said haltingly, I think both of them were there, with their backs to me, when I walked back downstairs.
Why do you ask? How can that matter?
It might not, said Strike. But can you remember anything at all? Hair or skin colour, maybe?
Looking even more perplexed, Bristow said, I'm afraid I didn't really register. I suppose...
He screwed up his face again in concentration.
I remember he was wearing blue. I mean, if pressed, I'd say he was white, but I couldn't swear to it.
I doubt you'll have to, said Strike. But that's still a help.
He pulled out his notebook to remind himself of the questions he had wanted to put to Bristow.
Oh, yeah. According to her witness statement to the police, Kiara Porter said that Lula had told her she wanted to leave everything to you.
Oh, said Bristow, unenthusiastically. That.
He began to amble along again, and Strike moved with him.
One of the detectives in charge of the case told me that Kiara had said that, a Detective Inspector Carver. He was convinced from the first that it was suicide, and he appeared to think that this supposed talk with Kiara demonstrated Lula's intent to take her own life. It seemed a strange line of reasoning to me. Do suicides bother with wills?
You think Kiara Porter's inventing, then?
Not inventing, said Bristow. Exaggerating, maybe. I think it's much more likely that Lula said something nice about me, because we'd just made up after our row, and Kiara, in hindsight, assuming that Lula was already contemplating suicide, turned whatever it was into a bequest. She's quite a fluffy sort of girl.
A search was made for a will, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, the police looked very thoroughly. We, the family, didn't think Lula had ever made one. Her lawyers didn't know of one. But naturally a search was made. Nothing was found, and they looked everywhere.
Just supposing for a moment that Kiara Porter isn't misremembering what your sister said, though.
But Lula would never have left everything solely to me, never.
Why not?
Because that would have explicitly cut out our mother, which would have been immensely hurtful, said Bristow earnestly. It isn't the money. Dad left Mum very well off. It's more the message that Lula would have been sending, cutting her out like that. Wills can cause all kinds of hurt. I've seen it happen countless times.
Has your mother made a will? Strike asked.
Bristow looked startled. Yes, I believe so.
May I ask who her legatees are?
I haven't seen it, said Bristow a little stiffly. How is this?
It's all relevant, John. 10 million quid is a hell of a lot of money.
Bristow seemed to be trying to decide whether or not Strike was being insensitive or offensive. Finally, he said, given that there is no other family, I would imagine that Tony and I are the main beneficiaries. Possibly one or two charities will be remembered. My mother has always been generous to charities. However, as I'm sure you'll understand, pink blotches were rising again up Bristow's thin neck. I am in no hurry to find out my mother's last wishes, given what must happen before they are acted upon.
Of course not, said Strike.
They had reached Bristow's office, an austere 8-story building entered by a dark archway.
Bristow stopped beside the entrance and faced Strike. "Do you still think I'm deluded?" he asked, as a pair of dark-suited women swept up past them.
"No," said Strike, honestly enough. "No, I don't."
Bristow's undistinguished countenance brightened a little. "I'll be in touch about Samay and Marlene Higson. Oh, and I nearly forgot. Lula's laptop. I've charged it for you, but it's password protected. The police people found out the password and they told my mother, but she can't remember what it was, and I never knew. Perhaps it was in the police file," he added hopefully.
"Not as far as I can remember," said Strike. "But that shouldn't be too much of a problem. Where has this been since Lula died?"
"In police custody and since then at my mother's. Nearly all Lula's things are lying around at Mum's. She hasn't worked herself up to making decisions about them." Bristow handed Strike the case and bid him farewell. Then, with a small bracing movement of his shoulders, he headed up the steps and disappeared through the doors of the family firm. Chapter 7. The friction between the end of Strike's amputated leg and the prosthesis was becoming more painful with every step as he headed towards Kensington Gore. Sweating a little in his heavy overcoat, while a weak sun made the park shimmer in the distance, Strike asked himself whether the strange suspicion that had him in its grip was anything more than a shadow moving in the depths of a muddy pool. A trick of the light, an illusory effect of the wind-ruffled surface. Had these minute flurries of black silt been flicked up by a slimy tail, or were they nothing but meaningless gusts of algae-fed gas? Could there be something lurking, disguised, buried in the mud, for which other nets had trawled in vain? Heading for Kensington Tube Station, he passed the Queen's Gate into Hyde Park, ornate, rust-red, and embellished with royal insignia. Incurably observant, he noted the sculpture of the doe and fawn on one pillar and the stag on the other. Humans often assume symmetry and equality where none existed. The same, yet profoundly different. Lula Landry's laptop banged harder and harder into his leg as his limp worsened. In his sore, stymied and frustrated state, there was a dull inevitability about Robin's announcement when he finally reached the office at 10 to 5, that she was still unable to penetrate past the telephone receptionist of Freddie Bestigui's production company, and that she had had no success in finding anyone of the name Onifade with a British Telecom number in the Kilburn area.
"Of course, if she's Rochelle's aunt, she could have a different surname, couldn't she?"
Robin pointed out, as she buttoned her coat and prepared to leave. Strike agreed to it wearily. He had dropped onto the sagging sofa the moment he had come through the office door, something that Robin had never seen him do before. His face was pinched.
"Are you all right?"
"Fine. Any sign of temporary solutions this afternoon?"
"No,"
said Robin, pulling her belt tight.
"Perhaps they believed me when I said I was Annabelle. I did try and sound Australian."
He grinned. Robin closed the interim report she had been reading while she waited for Strike to return, set it neatly back on its shelf, bade Strike good night, and left him sitting there, the laptop lying beside him on the threadbare cushions. When the sound of Robin's footsteps was no longer audible, Strike stretched a long arm sideways to lock the glass door, then broke his own weekday ban on smoking in the office. Jamming the lit cigarette between his teeth, he pulled up his trouser leg and unlaced the strap holding the prosthesis to his thigh. Then he unrolled the gel liner from the stump of his leg and examined the end of his amputated tibia. He was supposed to examine the skin surface for irritation every day. Now he saw that the scar tissue was inflamed and overwarm. There had been various creams and powders back in the bathroom cabinet at Charlotte's, dedicated to the care of this patch of skin, subject as it was these days to forces for which it had not been designed. Perhaps she had thrown the corn powder and oil artem into one of the still unpacked boxes. But he could not muster the energy to go and find out,
nor did he want to refit the prosthesis just yet. And so he sat, smoking on the sofa, with the lower trouser leg hanging empty towards the floor, lost in thought. His mind drifted. He thought about families and names, and about the ways in which his and John Bristow's childhoods, outwardly so different, had been similar. There were ghostly figures in Strike's family history, too. His mother's first husband, for instance, of whom she had rarely spoken, except to say that she had hated being married from the first. Aunt Joan, whose memory had always been sharpest where Leader's had been most vague, said that the 18-year-old Leader had run out on her husband after only 2 weeks, that her sole motivation in marrying Strike Senior, who, according to Aunt Joan, had arrived in St. Maur's with the fair, had been a new dress and a change of name. Certainly, Leader had remained more faithful to her unusual married moniker than to any man. She had passed it to her son, who had never met its original owner, long gone before his unconnected birth. Strike smoked, lost in thought, until the daylight in his office began to soften and dim. Then, at last, he struggled up on his one foot, and, using the doorknob and the dado rail on the wall beyond the glass door to steady himself, hopped out to examine the boxes still stacked on the landing outside his office. At the bottom of one of them, he found those dermatological products designed to assuage the burning and prickling in the end of his stump, and set to work to try and repair the damage first done by the long walk across London with his kit bag over his shoulder. It was lighter now than it had been at 8 o'clock 2 weeks ago, still daylight when Strike was seated, for the second time in 10 days, in Wong Kai, the tall, white-fronted Chinese restaurant with a window view of an arcade centre called Play to Win. It had been extremely painful to reattach the prosthetic leg, and still more to walk down Charing Cross Road on it, but he had disdained the use of the grey metal sticks he had also found in the box, relics of his release from Selly Oak Hospital. While Strike ate Singapore noodles one-handed, he examined Lula Landry's laptop, which lay open on the table, beside his beer. The dark pink computer casing was patterned with cherry blossom. It did not occur to Strike that he presented an incongruous appearance to the world as he hunched, large and hairy, over the prettified, pink and palpably feminine device, but the sight had drawn smirks from two of the black T-shirted waiters.
"How's tricks, Federico?"
asked a pallid, straggly-haired young man at 8:30. The newcomer, who dropped into the seat opposite Strike, wore jeans, a psychedelic T-shirt, Converse sneakers, and a leather bag slung diagonally across his chest.
"Been worse," grunted Strike. "How are you? Want a drink?"
"Yeah, I'll have a lager."
Strike ordered the drink for his guest, whom he was accustomed, for long-forgotten reasons, to call Spanner. Spanner had a first-class degree in computer science, and was much better paid than his clothing suggested.
"I'm not that hungry. I had a burger after work,"
Spanner said, looking down the menu.
"I could do a soup. Want some soup, please?"
he added to the waiter.
"Interesting choice of laptop, Fed."
"It's not mine," said Strike.
"It's the job, is it?"
"Yeah."
Strike slid the computer around to face Spanner, who surveyed the device with the mixture of interest and disparagement characteristic of those to whom technology is no necessary evil, but the stuff of life.
"Junk,"
said Spanner cheerfully.
"Where have you been hiding yourself, Fed? People have been worried."
"Nice of them," said Strike, through a mouthful of noodles. "No need, though."
"I was around Nick and Ilsa's a couple of nights ago, and you were the only topic of conversation. They were saying you've gone underground." "Oh, cheers,"
he said, as his soup arrived.
"Yeah, they've been ringing your flat and they keep getting the answering machine. Ilsa reckons it's woman trouble."
It now occurred to Strike that the best way to inform his friends of his ruptured engagement might be through the medium of the unconcerned Spanner. The younger brother of one of Strike's old friends, Spanner was largely ignorant of, and indifferent to, the long and tortured history of Strike and Charlotte. Given that it was face-to-face sympathy and post-mortems that Strike wanted to avoid,
and that he had no intention of pretending for ever that he and Charlotte had not split up, he agreed that Ilse had correctly divined his main trouble, and that it would be better if his friends avoided calling Charlotte's flat henceforth.
"Bummer,"
said Spanner. And then, with the incuriosity towards human pain versus technological challenges that was characteristic of him, he pointed a spatulate fingertip at the dell and asked,
"What you want doing with this, then?"
"The police have already had a look at it," said Strike, lowering his voice, even though he and Spanner were the only people nearby not speaking Cantonese. "But I want a second opinion."
"Police have got good techie people. I doubt I'm going to find anything they haven't."
"They might not have been looking for the right stuff," said Strike. "And they might not have realised what it meant, even if they found it. They seem mostly interested in her recent emails, and I've already seen them."
"What am I looking for, then?"
"All activity on or leading up to the 8th of January. The most recent internet searches, stuff like that. I haven't got the password, and I'd rather not go back to the police and ask unless I have to."
"Shouldn't be a problem,"
said Spanner. He was not writing these instructions down, but typing them onto his mobile phone. Spanner was 10 years younger than Strike, and he rarely wielded a pen by choice.
"Who's it belong to, anyway?"
When Strike told him, Spanner said,
"The model? Whoa!"
But Spanner's interest in human beings, even when dead or famous, was still secondary to his fondness for rare comics, technological innovation, and bands of which Strike had never heard. After eating several spoonfuls of soup, Spanner broke the silence to inquire brightly how much Strike was planning to pay him for the work. When Spanner had left with a pink laptop under his arm, Strike limped back to his office. He washed the end of his right leg carefully that night, and then applied cream to the irritated and inflamed scar tissue. For the first time in many months, he took painkillers before easing himself into his sleeping bag. Lying there, waiting for the raw ache to deaden, he wondered whether he ought to make an appointment to see the consultant in rehabilitation medicine under whose care he was supposed to fall. The symptoms of choke syndrome, the nemesis of amputees, had been described to him repeatedly: suppurating skin and swelling. He was wondering whether he might be showing the early signs, but he dreaded the prospect of returning to corridors stinking of disinfectant, of doctors with their detached interest in this one small, mutilated portion of his body. The further minute adjustments to the prosthesis, necessitating still more visits to that white-coated, confined world he had hoped he had left forever. He feared advice to rest the leg, to desist from normal ambulation, a forced return to crutches, the stares of passers-by at his pinned-up trouser leg, and the shrill inquiries of small children. His mobile, charging as usual on the floor beside the camp bed, made the buzzing noise that announced the arrival of a text. Glad for any minor distraction from his throbbing leg, Strike groped in the dark and picked up the telephone from the floor. "Please, could you give me a quick call when convenient? Charlotte." Strike did not believe in clairvoyance or psychic ability, yet his immediate irrational thought was that Charlotte had somehow sensed what he had just told Spanner, that he had twitched the taut, invisible rope still binding them by placing their breakup on an official footing. He stared at the message as though it was her face, as though he could read her expression on the tiny grey screen. "Please. I know you don't have to. I'm asking you to, nicely. A quick call. I have a legitimate reason for desiring speech with you, so we can do it swiftly and easily, no rows. When convenient. I do you the courtesy of assuming that you have a busy life without me. Or perhaps, please, to refuse is to be a bastard, Strike, and you've hurt me enough. A quick call. I know you're expecting a scene. Well, don't worry, that last one, when you were such an unbelievable shit, has finished me with you forever. When convenient, because let's be honest, I always had to slot in around the army and every other damn thing that came first.
Was it convenient now? He asked himself, lying in pain that the pills had yet to touch. He glanced at the time. 11:10. She was clearly still awake. He put the mobile back on the floor beside him, where it lay silently charging, and raised a large hairy arm over his eyes, blotting out even the strips of light on the ceiling cast by the street lamps through the window slats. Against his will, he saw Charlotte the way that he had laid eyes on her for the first time in his life, as she sat alone on a windowsill at a student party in Oxford. He had never seen anything so beautiful in his life, and nor, judging by the sideways flickering of countless male eyes, the overloud laughter and voices, the angling of extravagant gestures towards her silent figure, had any of the rest of them. Gazing across the room, the 19-year-old Strike had been visited by precisely the same urge that had come over him as a child whenever snow had fallen overnight in Aunt Joan and Uncle Ted's garden. He wanted his footsteps to be the first to make deep, dark holes in that tantalizingly smooth surface. He wanted to disturb and disrupt it.
"You're pissed," warned his friend, when Strike announced his intention to go and talk to her. Strike agreed, down the dregs of his seventh pint, and strode purposefully over to the window ledge where she sat. He was vaguely aware of people nearby watching, primed perhaps for laughter, because he was massive and looked like a boxing Beethoven and had curry sauce all down his T-shirt. She looked up at him when he reached her, with big eyes and long dark hair and soft pale cleavage revealed by the gaping shirt. Strike's strange nomadic childhood, with its constant uprootings and graftings on to motley groups of children and teenagers, had forged in him an advanced set of social skills. He knew how to fit in, to make people laugh, to render himself acceptable to almost anyone. That night, his tongue had become numb and rubbery. He seemed to remember swaying slightly. "Did you want something?" she asked.
"Yeah," he said.
He pulled his T-shirt away from his torso and showed her the curry sauce.
"What do you reckon's the best way to get this out?"
Against her will, he saw her trying to fight it. She giggled. Sometime later, an Adonis called the Honourable Jago Ross, known to Strike by sight and reputation, swung into the room with a posse of equally well-bred friends, and discovered Strike and Charlotte sitting side by side on the windowsill, deep in conversation.
"You're in the wrong fucking room, Char, darling," Ross had said, staking out his rights by the caressing arrogance of his tone. "Rich's party's upstairs."
"I'm not coming," she said, turning a smiling face upon him. "I've got to go and help Cormor and soak his T-shirt."
Thus, she had publicly dumped her old Harrovian boyfriend for Cormor and Strike. It had been the most glorious moment of Strike's 19 years. He had publicly carried off Helen of Troy right under Menelaus's nose, and in his shock and delight, he had not questioned the miracle, but simply accepted it. Only later had he realized that what had seemed like chance or fate had been entirely engineered by her. She had admitted it to him months later, that she had, to punish Ross for some transgression, deliberately entered the wrong room and waited for a man, any man, to approach her. That he, Strike, had been a mere instrument to torture Ross. That she had slept with him in the early hours of the following morning in a spirit of vengefulness and rage that he had mistaken for passion. There, in that first night, had been everything that had subsequently broken them apart and pulled them back together. Her self-destructiveness, her recklessness, her determination to hurt, her unwilling but genuine attraction to Strike, and her secure place of retreat in the cloistered world in which she had grown up, whose values she simultaneously despised and espoused. Thus had begun the relationship that had led to Strike lying here on his camp bed 15 years later, racked with more than physical pain, and wishing that he could rid himself of her memory.
Chapter 8 When Robin arrived next morning, it was, for the second time, to a locked glass door. She let herself in with a spare key that Strike had now entrusted to her, approached the closed inner door, and stood silent, listening. After a few seconds, she heard the faintly muffled but unmistakable sound of deep snoring. This presented her with a delicate problem, because of their tacit agreement not to mention Strike's camp bed, or any of the other signs of habitation lying around the place. On the other hand, Robin had something of an urgent nature to communicate to her temporary boss. She hesitated, considering her options. The easiest route would be to try and wake Strike by clattering around the outer office, thereby giving him time to organize himself in the inner room, but that might take too long. Her news would not keep. Robin therefore took a deep breath and rapped on the door. Strike woke instantly. For one disorientated moment he lay there, registering the reproachful daylight pouring through the window. Then he remembered setting down the mobile phone after reading Charlotte's text, and knew that he had forgotten to set the alarm.
"Don't come in!" he bellowed.
"Would you like a cup of tea?"
Robin called through the door.
"Yeah, that'd be great. I'll come out there for it,"
Strike added loudly, wishing for the first time that he had fitted a lock on the inner door. His false foot and calf were standing propped against the wall, and he was wearing nothing but boxer shorts. Robin hurried away to fill the kettle, and Strike fought his way out of his sleeping bag. He dressed at speed, making a clumsy job of putting on the prosthesis, folding the camp bed into its corner, pushing the desk back into place. 10 minutes after she had knocked on the door, he limped into the outer office, smelling strongly of deodorant, to find Robin at her desk, looking very excited about something.
"Your tea?"
she said, indicating a steaming mug.
"Great, thanks. Just give me a moment," he said,
and he left to pee in the bathroom on the landing. As he zipped up his fly, he caught sight of himself in the mirror, crumpled-looking and unshaven. Not for the first time, he consoled himself that his hair looked the same whether brushed or unbrushed.
"I've got news," said Robin,
when he had re-entered the office through the glass door, and, with reiterated thanks, picked up his mug of tea.
"Yeah?"
"I found Rochelle Onifade."
He lowered the mug.
"You're kidding. How the hell?"
"I saw in the file that she was supposed to attend an outpatient clinic at St. Thomas's," said Robin excitedly, flushed and talking fast. "So, I rang up the hospital yesterday evening pretending to be her, and I said I'd forgotten the time of my appointment, and they told me it's at 10:30 on Thursday morning. You've got," she glanced at her computer monitor, 55 minutes.
Why had he not thought to tell her to do this?
"You genius, you bloody genius."
He had slopped hot tea over his hand and put the mug down on her desk.
"Do you know exactly?"
"It's in the psychiatric unit round the back of the main building," said Robin, exhilarated. "See, you go in off Grantley Road. There's a second car park."
She had turned the monitor towards him to show him the map of St. Thomas's. He checked his wrist, but his watch was still in the inner room.
"You'll have time if you leave now," Robin urged him.
"Yeah, I'll get my stuff."
Strike hurried to fetch his watch, wallet, cigarettes and phone. He was almost through the glass door, cramming his wallet into his back pocket, when Robin said,
Cormoran.
She had never called him by his first name before. Strike assumed that this accounted for her slight air of bashfulness. Then he realized that she was pointing meaningfully at his navel. Looking down, he saw that he had done up the buttons on his shirt wrongly, and was exposing a patch of belly so hairy that it resembled black coconut matting.
"Oh, right. Cheers."
Robin turned her attention politely to her monitor while he undid and refastened the buttons.
"See you later."
"Yeah, bye," she said,
smiling at him as he departed at speed. But within seconds he was back, panting slightly.
"Robin, I need you to check something."
She already had the pen in her hand, waiting.
There was a legal conference in Oxford on the 7th of January. Lula Landry's Uncle Tony attended it, international family law. Anything you can find out, specifically about him being there.
Right, said Robin, scribbling.
Cheers, you're a genius.
And he was gone, with uneven steps, down the metal stairs. Though she hummed to herself as she settled down at her desk, a little of Robin's cheerfulness drained away as she drank her tea. She had half hoped that Strike would invite her along to meet Rochelle Onifade, whose shadow she had hunted for 2 weeks. Rush hour passed. The crowds on the tube had thinned. Strike was pleased, because the end of his stump was still smarting, to find a seat with ease. He had bought himself a pack of extra-strong mints at the station kiosk before boarding his train, and was now sucking four simultaneously, trying to conceal the fact that he had not had time to clean his teeth. His toothbrush and toothpaste were hidden inside his kit bag, even though it would have been much more convenient to leave them on the chip sink in the bathroom. Catching sight of himself again in a darkened train window, with his heavy stubble and his generally unkempt appearance, he asked himself why, when it was perfectly obvious that Robin knew he slept there, he maintained the fiction that he had some other home. Strike's memory and map sense were more than adequate to the task of locating the entrance to the psychiatric unit at St. Thomas's, and he proceeded there without mishap, arriving at shortly after 10. He spent 5 minutes checking that the automatic double doors were the only entrance on Grantley Road, before positioning himself on a stone wall in the car park, some 20 yards away from the entrance, giving him a clear view of everyone entering and leaving. Knowing only that the girl he sought was probably homeless, and certainly black, he had thought through his strategy for finding her on the tube, and concluded that there was really only one option open to him. At 10:20, therefore, when he saw a tall, thin black girl walking briskly towards the entrance, he called out, even though she looked too well-groomed, too neatly dressed,
"Rochelle!"
She glanced up to see who had shouted, but kept walking without any sign that the name had a personal application, and disappeared into the building. Next came a couple, both white, then a group of people of assorted ages and races, whom Strike guessed to be hospital workers, but on the mere off chance he called again,
"Rochelle!"
Some of them glanced at him, but returned immediately to their conversations. Consoling himself that frequenters of this entrance were probably used to a degree of eccentricity in those they met in its vicinity, Strike lit a cigarette and waited. 10:30 passed, and no black girl went through the doors. Either she had missed her appointment, or she had used a different entrance. A feather-like breeze tickled the back of his neck as he sat smoking, watching, waiting. The hospital building was enormous. A vast concrete box with rectangular windows. There were surely numerous entrances on every side. Strike straightened his injured leg, which was still sore, and considered again the possibility that he would have to return to see his consultant. He found even this degree of proximity to a hospital slightly depressing. His stomach rumbled. He had passed a McDonald's on the way here. If he had not found her by midday, he would go and eat there. Twice more he shouted, "Rochelle!" at black women who entered and exited the building, and both times they glanced back, purely to see who had shouted, in one case giving him a look of disdain. Then, just after 11, a short, stocky black girl emerged from the hospital with a slightly awkward, rocking, side-to-side gait. He knew quite well that he had not missed her going in, not only because of her distinctive walk, but because she wore a very noticeable short coat of magenta-coloured fake fur, which flattered neither her height nor her breadth.
"Rochelle!"
The girl stopped, turned, and stared around, scowling, looking for the person who had called her name. Strike limped towards her, and she glared at him with an understandable mistrust.
"Rochelle? Rochelle on the far day? Hi. My name's Cormoran Strike. Can I have a word?"
"I always come in Redbourne Street entrance," she told him 5 minutes later, after he had given a garbled and fictitious account of the way he had found her.
I come out this way because I was going to go to McDonald's.
So that was where they went. Strike bought two coffees and two large cookies and carried them to the window table where Rochelle was waiting, curious and suspicious. She was uncompromisingly plain. Her greasy skin, which was the colour of burned earth, was covered in acne pustules and pits. Her small eyes were deep set, and her teeth were crooked and rather yellow. The chemically straightened hair showed 4 inches of black roots, then 6 inches of harsh, coppery wire red. Her tight, too short jeans, her shiny grey handbag, and her bright white trainers looked cheap. However, the squashy fake fur jacket, garish and unflattering though Strike found it, was of a different quality altogether. Fully lined, as he saw when she took it off, with a patterned silk, and bearing the label not, as he had expected, remembering Lula Landry's email to the designer of Guy Sommet, but of an Italian of whom even Strike had heard.
"You sure you in a journalist?"
she asked, in her low, husky voice. Strike had already spent some time outside the hospital trying to establish his bona fides in this respect.
"No, I'm not a journalist. Like I said, I know Lula's brother."
"You a friend of his?"
"Yeah. Well, not exactly a friend. He's hired me. I'm a private detective."
She was instantly, openly scared.
"What do you want to talk to me for?"
"There is nothing to worry about."
"Why do you want to talk to me, though?"
"It's nothing bad. John isn't sure that Lula committed suicide, that's all."
He guessed that the only thing keeping her in the seat was her terror of the construction he might put on instant flight. Her fear was out of all proportion to his manner or words.
"There's nothing to worry about," he assured her again. "John wants me to take another look at the circumstances. That's..."
"Does he say I've got something to do with her dying?"
"No, of course not. I'm just hoping you might be able to tell me about her state of mind. What she got up to in the lead-up to her death. You saw her regularly, didn't you? I thought you might be able to tell me what was going on in her life."
Rochelle made as though to speak, then changed her mind and attempted to drink her scalding coffee instead.
"So what? Her brother's trying to make out she never killed herself. What, like she was pushed out the window?"
"He thinks it's possible." She seemed to be trying to fathom something, to work it out in her head.
"I don't have to talk to you. You ain't real police."
"Yeah, that's true. But wouldn't you like to help find out what?"
"She jumped,"
declared Rochelle Onifade firmly.
"What makes you so sure?" asked Strike.
"I just know."
"It seems to have come as a shock to nearly everyone else she knew."
"She was depressed. Yeah, she was on stuff for it, like me. Sometimes it just takes you over, it's an illness," she said,
although she made the word sound like it's an illness. Nilness, thought Strike, for a second distracted. He had slept badly. Nilness, that was where Lula Landry had gone, and where all of them, he and Rochelle included, were headed. Sometimes illness turned slowly to nilness, as was happening to Bristow's mother. Sometimes nilness rose to meet you out of nowhere, like a concrete road slamming your skull apart. He was sure that if he took out his notebook, she would clam up or leave. He therefore continued to ask questions as casually as he could manage, asking her how she had come to attend the clinic, how she had first met Lula. Still immensely suspicious, she gave monosyllabic answers at first, but slowly, gradually, she became more forthcoming. Her own history was pitiful. Early abuse, care, severe mental illness, foster homes, and violent outbursts culminating at 16 in homelessness. She had secured proper treatment as the indirect result of being hit by a car. Hospitalized when her bizarre behavior had made treating her physical wounds nearly impossible, a psychiatrist had at last been called in. She was on drugs now which, when she took them, greatly eased her symptoms. Strike found it pathetic and touching that the outpatient clinic where she had met Lula Landry seemed to have become, for Rochelle, the highlight of her week. She spoke with some affection of the young psychiatrist who ran the group.
"So that's where you met Lula?"
"Didn't her brother tell you?"
"He was vague on the details."
"Yeah, she come to our group. She was referred."
"And you got talking?"
"Yeah."
"You became friends?"
"Yeah."
"You visited her at home? Swam in the pool?"
"Why shouldn't I?"
"No reason, I'm only asking."
She thawed very slightly.
"I don't like swimming. I don't like water over my face. I went in the jacuzzi and we went shopping and stuff."
"Did she ever talk to you about her neighbours? The other people in her building?"
"Them Bestiguis, a bit. She didn't like them. That woman's a bitch,"
said Rochelle with sudden savagery.
"What makes you say that?"
"Have you met her? She look at me like I was dirt."
"What did Lula think of her?"
"She didn't like her neither, nor her husband. He's a creep."
"In what way?"
"He just is,"
said Rochelle impatiently. But then, when Strike did not speak, she went on.
"He was always trying to get her downstairs when his wife was out."
"Did Lula ever go?"
"No fucking chance," said Rochelle.
"You and Lula talked to each other a lot, I suppose, did you?"
"Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did."
She looked out of the window. A sudden shower of rain had caught passers-by unawares. Transparent ellipses peppered the glass beside them.
"At first," said Strike. "Did you talk less as time went on?"
"I'm going to have to go soon," said Rochelle grandly. "I've got things to do."
"People like Lula," said Strike, feeling his way, "can be spoiled. Treat people badly. They're used to getting their own..."
"I ain't no one's servant," said Rochelle fiercely.
"Maybe that's why she liked you. Maybe she saw you as someone more equal, not a hanger-on."
"Yeah, exactly," said Rochelle, mollified. "I weren't impressed by her."
"You can see why she'd want you as a friend. Someone more down to earth."
"Yeah."
"And you had your illness in common, didn't you? So you understood her on a level most people wouldn't."
"And I'm black," said Rochelle. "And she was wanting to feel proper black."
"Did she talk to you about that?"
"Yeah, of course," said Rochelle. "She was wanting to find out where she come from, where she belong."
"Did she talk to you about trying to find the black side of her family?"
"Yeah, of course. And she..." "Yeah."
She had braked almost visibly.
"Did she ever find anyone? A father?"
"No, she never found him. No fucking chance."
"Really?"
"Yeah, really."
She began eating fast. Strike was afraid that she would leave the moment she had finished.
"Was Lula depressed when you met her at Vashti, the day before she died?"
"Yeah, she was."
"Did she tell you why?"
"There don't have to be a reason why. It's an illness."
"But she told you she was feeling bad, did she?"
"Yeah,"
she said, after a fractional hesitation.
"You were supposed to be having lunch together, weren't you?" he asked. "Kieran told me that he drove her to meet you. You know Kieran, right? Kieran Colobus-Jones?"
Her expression softened. The corners of her mouth lifted.
"Yeah, I know Kieran. Yeah. She come to meet me at Vashti."
"But she didn't start for lunch."
"No, she was in a hurry," said Rochelle.
She bowed her head to drink more coffee, concealing her face.
"Why didn't she just ring you? You've got a phone, have you?"
"Yeah, I got a phone,"
she snapped, bristling, and drew from the fur jacket a basic-looking Nokia, stuck all over with gaudy pink crystals.
"So why do you think she didn't call to say she couldn't see you?"
Rochelle glowered at him.
"Because she didn't like using the phone. Because of them listening in."
"Journalists?"
"Yeah."
She had almost finished her cookie.
"Journalists wouldn't have been very interested in her saying that she wasn't coming to Vashti, though, would they?"
"I don't know."
"Didn't you think it was odd at the time that she drove all the way to tell you she couldn't stay for lunch?"
"Yeah, no,"
said Rochelle. And then, with a sudden burst of fluency,
"When you got a driver, it don't matter, does it? You just go wherever you want. Don't cost you nothing extra. You just get them to take you, don't you? She was passing, so she come in to tell me she wasn't going to stop because she had to get home to see fucking Kiara Porter.
Rochelle looked as though she regretted the traitorous fucking as soon as it was out, and pursed her lips together as though to ensure no more swear words escaped her.
And that was all she did, was it? She came into the shop, said, I can't stop, I've got to get home and see Kiara, and left.
Yeah, more or less, said Rochelle.
Kieran says they usually gave you a lift home after you'd been out together.
Yeah,
she said.
Well, she was too busy that day, weren't she?
Rochelle did a poor job of masking her resentment. Talk me through what happened in the shop. Did either of you try anything on?
Yeah,
said Rochelle after a pause.
She did.
Another hesitation.
Long Alexander McQueen dress. He killed himself and all,
she added, in a distant voice.
Did you go into the changing room with her?
Yeah.
What happened in the changing room? Prompted Strike.
Her eyes reminded him of those of a bull he had once come face to face with as a small boy, deep-set, deceptively stoic, unfathomable.
She put on the dress, said Rochelle.
She didn't do anything else, didn't call anyone.
No. Well, yeah, she might have.
Do you know who she called?
I can't remember.
She drank, obscuring her face again with the paper cup.
Was it Evan Duffield?
It might have been.
Can you remember what she said?
No.
One of the shop assistants overheard her while she was on the phone. She seemed to be making an appointment to meet someone at her flat much later. In the early hours of the morning, the girl thought.
Yeah?
So that doesn't seem like it could have been Duffield, does it? Seeing as she already had an arrangement to meet him at Uzi.
Know a lot, don't you?
She said.
Everyone knows they met at Uzi that night, said Strike. It was in all the papers.
The dilating or contracting of Rochelle's pupils would be almost impossible to see because of the virtually black irises surrounding them.
Yeah, I suppose,
she conceded.
Was it D.B. Mack?
No!
She yelped it on a laugh.
She didn't know his number.
Famous people can nearly always get each other's numbers, said Strike.
Rochelle's expression clouded. She glanced down at the blank screen on her gaudy pink mobile.
I don't think she had his,
she said.
But you heard her trying to make an arrangement to meet someone in the small hours.
No,
said Rochelle, avoiding his eyes, swilling the dregs of her coffee around the paper cup.
I can't remember nothing like that.
You understand how important this could be, said Strike, careful to keep his tone unthreatening.
If Lula made an arrangement to meet someone at the time she died, the police never knew about this, did they? You never told them?
I gotta go,
she said, throwing down the last morsel of cookie, grabbing the strap of her cheap handbag and glaring at him.
Strike said, It's nearly lunchtime. Can I buy you anything else?
No.
But she did not move. He wondered how poor she was, whether she ate regularly or not. There was something about her, beneath the surliness, that he found touching. A fierce pride, a vulnerability.
Yeah, all right then, she said,
dropping her handbag and slumping back onto the hard chair.
I'll have a Big Mac.
He was afraid she might leave while he was at the counter, but when he returned with two trays, she was still there. She even thanked him grudgingly. Strike tried a different tack.
You know Kieran quite well, do you?
He asked, pursuing the glow that had illuminated her at the mention of his name.
Yeah?
She said, self-consciously.
I met him a lot with her. He was always driving her.
He says that Lula was writing something in the back of the car before she arrived at Vashti.
Did she show